Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today's broadcast of Intelligent Medicine is dedicated to the memory of James Gandolfini, a fabulous actor and, of course, the star of The Sopranos, who gave us such a wonderful legacy of great character and fantastic entertainment, creating a whole universe that many of us followed for so many years. We would rush home to catch the broadcast on HBO, and we would revel in the characters. And he was a villain, but he was also a very sympathetic villain. And it was kind of ironic that during that broadcast, Tony Soprano would frequently clutch his chest in horror, suspecting that he was having a heart attack. Turned out that he was suffering from panic episodes. Typically, it's hard to distinguish sometimes between the chest pressure and pain of a panic episode and a heart attack. But here, in this instance, he succumbed actually in real life to a heart attack, in the supreme irony. And there's been all kinds of spin in the past few days. There was a big New York Post article, which was kind of a snarky article, a little bit in the spirit of Schadenfreude, about how James Gandolfini did himself in with a very high-fat meal and a whole lot of drinks after his evening out with his son in Rome. There are actually pictures of him sitting at a piazza in Rome, dining al fresco with drinks and a large plate of food in front of him. And it's thought that this may have contributed to his sudden death. And I think it's important to take a look at some of the causes of this problem, because, well, we don't want to engage in a morality play here, suggesting that we're morally superior because we're alive and he's dead. On the other hand, you know, while a lot of people are bereaved, his family, his fans, the cast members of The Sopranos and other productions that he worked on, because he had a long, illustrious dramatic career. But among the people that are most perplexed, and I know this feeling, are his physicians. We know nothing about the kind of medical care that he's undergone, but it might actually be worthwhile to speculate on how such a scenario could be averted, because lots of us are pushing 51 or perhaps past 51, and some of us are wondering, how can we avoid this this fate, sudden death that seemingly came out of the blue, with no warning signs and nothing to prevent it. Well, what are some of the ways that we can address the risk and understand what happened to James Gandolfini? Well, I know the feeling that a physician has when a patient has a negative outcome, because I really sweat it when I hear that my patients have had a problem. The first thing I do sometimes when I hear a patient's in the hospital or has had some sort of setback is I go to the chart and I look and I see, you know, were there any tests that I have done? Were there any medical records that it could have foretold that a patient was going to have one or another problem? Did I miss anything? I rack my brains often when this happens. Fortunately, it's not a frequent occurrence among my wellness-oriented patients, many of whom are real health-conscious individuals. But sometimes, inexplicably, bad stuff happens to good people, well-meaning people, people who are even undertaking a healthy program, and we try to figure out why. It's sort of Monday morning quarterbacking, and we hope to learn, was there something that we missed? So, you know, let's take a look at this phenomenon of a guy relatively young who suddenly drops dead after what appears to be a very indulgent, heavy meal in a Roman restaurant, is it possible that a single meal can do you in? And the answer is, according to research, there's actually several studies that look at the effect of a single high-fat meal. And we know that James Gandolfini consumed fried calamari, according to the accounts, and pâté de foie, which is a very high-fat pâté of goose liver. A little more on that later in the podcast, you know, because how do you get pâté de foie? Well, it's kind of a cautionary tale for humans, the way that they create a very fatty duck liver. We'll talk a little bit about that in just a few moments. But according to research, a single high-fat meal may raise the risk of blood clotting. Here's the experiment. A study found that a single meal, very high in fat, may increase heart attack and stroke risk by increasing the activity of something called factor 7. Factor 7 is a blood factor which encourages blood clotting. And so the study involved feeding 18 healthy young men different fat meals. And what they found was when individuals were given a high-fat meal, there was a significant increase in factor 7, which promotes blood coagulation. A 60% higher amount of this clotting factor was found after a very high-fat meal compared to blood levels of the men after eating a low-fat meal. So the term for this is that it's prothrombotic. It encourages the creation of blood clots wherever the body may be most vulnerable. If you got pre-atherosclerosis in your carotid arteries, you might get a stroke. If you have pre-atherosclerosis in your coronary arteries, you might have a heart attack. There's some other studies that show that big meals and very high-fat meals can sometimes increase the amount of free radicals that may attack blood vessel walls, creating transient inflammation, which may constrict blood vessels or increase the stickiness of blood vessel walls to attract platelets to cause a blood clot. So there's a plausible scenario for how a very big meal, overconsumption of food, could actually do you in. There's another factor involved, which is, according to various reports, high alcohol consumption. High alcohol consumption can be a factor that causes something called holiday heart syndrome. This is something that we saw all the time when I was a medical resident at the Veterans Administration Hospital here in Manhattan, 30 years ago or so. We would dread being on call during, say, the 4th of July weekend or during Labor Day or over Christmas, because we would see a lot of what was called holiday heart. With the extra time off, lots of parties, people, in this particular case, veterans, would overindulge in alcohol. And what that tends to do is it tends to increase the risk for cardiac arrhythmias, rapid heart rate, that can sometimes increase the risk for a heart attack or increase the risk for a blood clot, which could block one of the main coronary arteries. So there's a couple of factors that, you know, could have been directly contributory to this horrible tragedy: alcohol and excess food consumption, a very high-fat meal. One of the concerns that, you know, and I'm sure that James Gandolfini's physicians are just racking their brains about this. They're saying, how could we have predicted this? And, you know, I wonder if this is ever going to come out. Did he have a medical workup which would reveal his risk factors? Now, one obvious risk factor, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to notice this, is that he was an overweight individual. He was, by recent reports, he was 260 pounds on a large frame, but he was always a big guy. And that clearly is one of the major risk factors for heart attacks. Did he have high cholesterol? Did he have high levels of insulin? Was he pre-diabetic? These are tests that I often undertake in patients who are concerned about cardiovascular risk. We also look at homocysteine. We look at Lp(a). When stress tests don't reveal much information, sometimes you can have a perfectly normal stress test. It would be interesting to note if Gandolfini had a recent stress test, or if ever he had a stress test. But sometimes you can have normal stress tests and still develop problems. So what we do is we look more closely with what's called an EBT heart scan to see if calcium is beginning to form in the coronary arteries. If you have very little or no calcium, very low likelihood of a heart attack, although it's not impossible, but that's a pretty good marker for risk. We also slice and dice the cholesterol. We don't just look at the overall cholesterol. We look at the HDL. We look at subunits of LDL, the oxidized LDL, and we look at LDL particle size. And all these aggregate to risk factors for cardiovascular disease. And then preventive measures could be undertaken. So it would be of interest to note if Gandolfini, say, was on an aspirin. Was he taking the so-called baby aspirin as a prophylaxis against a heart attack? Was he given statin drugs because of high cholesterol? Was he on other medications to control blood pressure? Unfortunately, these measures are not 100% in terms of completely avoiding the risk of heart attack. You can't make yourself heart attack proof simply with medication. For every person who dies in this country of a heart attack, a high percentage of them are already taking these medications. They're the very people who are at risk, but these medications are not 100% foolproof in terms of preventing problems. But it would be interesting if we could get the information, because it would be, you know, a cautionary tale. It would tell us a little bit more about what to look for and who would be at risk. It's entirely possible that either Gandolfini hadn't had very close medical follow-up. Sometimes stars are a little eccentric. They don't go to doctors. They don't get checkups. Or maybe he was a refusenik. Maybe he was a non-compliant patient. Maybe his doctors admonished him, take medications, lose weight, start exercising, and he did none of that. We don't know anything about his personal history. But I'm sure, you know, there's some doctors out there, if he's had any kind of medical encounters, that are just racking their brains. What could they have done to forestall this terrible tragedy? But here's a scary story, and it comes to us from a study done in 2011. It was a review of something called the U.S. National Registry of Myocardial Infarction for the period 1994 to 2006. Now, clearly, risk factors predict heart disease. So risk factors include, do you have a family history of heart disease? Are you overweight? Are you diabetic? Do you have high blood pressure? Do you have high cholesterol? Are you a smoker? Do you exercise? And so on and so on and so on. But what they found was very disconcerting. First of all, predictably, they found that patients with multiple risk factors, say, you know, you're overweight and they're hypertensive and they have high cholesterol, this is a no-brainer. They present much earlier in age than patients with fewer or no risk. They get heart attacks earlier. Okay, so far, so good. And that means that we ought to be on the lookout for risk factors. But here's the scary part. Of the patients who got heart attacks, about 15% had no risk factors for heart disease when admitted to the hospital. All right. So, also, if you had no risk factors for heart disease, well, you were less likely to have a heart attack in the first place. But if you did get a heart attack, here's the scary part. You're more likely to die of your heart attack. Now, that doesn't make a lot of sense because, well, clean living people with no risk factors, they're not overweight, everything's going good. Well, they tend to get heart attacks later. But if they do get a heart attack, they're more likely to die. All right, they call this risk factor paradox or reverse epidemiology. And so it's not clear what this is due to. One possible explanation is that higher risk patients might have gradually adapted to their disease, perhaps by forming collateral circulation to compensate for clogged arteries. In other words, if you gradually develop disease, then you've got like detours. Say, you know, it's like if the Long Island Expressway is blocked or clogged, people look for, they head for the service roads. They tend to go cross country to get to their destination. And that's the same thing that happens if you are gradually developing heart disease over the years. But if you don't have a lot of risk factors and you suddenly have something that causes you to have a heart attack, it's thought that your heart attack may be dangerous and more likely to be fatal. And here's another possible explanation. People with risk factors may be aware of risk factors. You know, if you're very overweight, if it's obvious you have high cholesterol, you're going to get a lot of medical attention. And then they're more likely to be on treatments to modify their risk of dying, such as using aspirin, statin drugs, blood pressure medications, all the things that actually have been shown to have some efficacy in reducing heart attack risk. Additionally, some of these patients who they know that they have multiple risk factors, maybe they're more conscientious about getting on exercise programs or eating better or perhaps even taking nutritional supplements to prevent heart disease. Other people may be saying, I'm fine. They're oblivious to risk. They're told that they're okay because they have no obvious risk factors. But inside, their coronary arteries may be occluding and they may be headed for trouble. So the ones with risk factors, maybe they're getting more medical attention or maybe they're more conscientious. This is referred to as risk factor paradox or reverse epidemiology. So, yeah, I don't think that you could say that James Gandolfini fit into that particular category because, you know, just to look at him, you'd say, this guy's got risk factors. He looks like, I mean, according to some of the Monday morning quarterbacks who were commenting on this in the news, doctors who were interviewed about his death, they said he looked like a walking time bomb, you know, and that he was a typical middle-aged male who is at very high risk. So, a terrible tragedy has occurred, and we'd like to learn from this because many of us are thinking, well, I'm 49, or I'm 54, or I'm 68, and they tell me I'm fine. But what if, I'm enjoying dinner with one of my kids on a vacation? I go a little bit overboard on the food and drink intake. Will I, too, be at risk for a massive, sudden, fatal coronary event? And I think that that's really the art of preventive medicine, is to help people forestall these types of problems, to provide them with early warning. Unfortunately, there's no such thing as 100% foresight with these types of things. And, bad stuff sometimes happens to good people, even conscientious individuals who are following a proper program of vitamins, supplements, diet, exercise, weight maintenance, and if necessary, taking the proper medications. I promised to talk about pâté de foie gras, which was one of the dishes that Gandolfini was said to have consumed at his Last Supper. And the origin of pâté de foie gras, it's actually fatty goose liver. And a lot of people who are animal rights activists, and not even necessarily the PETA folks, but just generally people who are for humane treatment of animals, not necessarily extremists, think of this as the penultimate animal cruelty, because the way that you make pâté de foie gras is literally by force-feeding geese with a funnel down their beaks. And they feed them, they basically feed them bread. They actually pour this down their gullet. And it's an example of how high intake of carbohydrates can actually result in fat deposition in the liver. Fatty liver is a very, very common problem in America. And it's kind of an illustrative situation. When you take a goose and force feed them starchy carbohydrates, the excess fat accumulates in the liver. It also creates high triglycerides in the bloodstream. If anyone wants to know what high triglycerides in the bloodstream looks like, you see these globules of fat particles that circulate around. These globules overwhelm the circulation and end up getting stuck in the liver. The liver swells enormously with beadlets of fat. Instead of being a nice brown color, it turns yellow. And the blood resembles, instead of resembling nice dark blood like cherry juice, it starts to resemble cold borscht with dollops of sour cream in it. It tends to take on sort of a pink color. It thickens. And that's a very, very dangerous cardiovascular situation. So the point being, let's not force feed our geese because it's inhumane. Boycott pâté de foie gras. But also, don't force feed yourself with starchy carbohydrates and high fructose corn syrup. High fructose corn syrup, by the way, is particularly likely to result in fatty liver, according to research. We consume too much of it via soft drinks and candies, but also in some individuals who are susceptible through consuming too much fruit juice and even in eating too much fresh fruit. This can actually result in high levels of triglycerides in the blood, which often correspond to risk factors for deposition of fat within the liver. And so make sure that you too don't turn yourself into a Strasbourg goose. That will not be beneficial for your long-term health. Okay, there's an interesting new development, and it has all kinds of societal ramifications. The American Medical Association has just officially recognized obesity as a disease. They just had a meeting, and they convened, and this is an issue that they took up, and it was a controversial issue, because is obesity just, you know, part of the human spectrum? You know, some people are thin, and some people are normal weight, and some people are heavy. Or is it a disease? And this is very controversial because it has ramifications. If it's if obesity is a disease, well, diseases are categorized in the American Disability Act as it's necessary to recognize that it is a medical condition. And one wonders, will this open the door to more litigation because people will sue because they were made obese, they were given a disease. This is not, a character flaw. This is actually a medical condition. I mean, do you get, are you stigmatized because you have HIV? No, it's recognized as a disease. I mean, yes, you may have contracted it because of needle use or unsafe sex. But just as people get injuries in motorcycle accidents, they're disabled. and they should be accorded full recognition under the law, with the potential for, well, you know, you're already one step ahead of me, collecting disability, because after all, it's a disease. So you're overweight, and maybe this is the basis for collecting medical disability. You know, one can envision that this is something that could come down the line. One of the upsides of this, and this has actually been pointed out to me by one of my nephews, who is a very accomplished bariatric surgeon. He specializes in those types of surgeries, gastric bypass and gastric banding, and the kind of thing that that Governor Christie had, which is a little bit of a less drastic surgery, that he believes that this is a really good move, because what this is going to do, it's going to encourage more people to obtain medical help for their obesity. And of course, you know, one unintended consequence of this is that more insurers will pay for bariatric surgery and for treatments for obesity. This is also going to be controversial, because now we've added obesity to the roster of diseases that need to be covered by medical insurance. Because, I mean, how can you discriminate against people who have obesity when this has now been declared a disease? I mean, if you have, you know, if you have rheumatoid arthritis, you know, you're entitled to treatment. If you've got a stroke or a heart attack, you're entitled to treatment. And obesity treatment may, you know, have to. I mean, there's going to be maybe court challenges when people say, look, I need my obesity treatment. I'm overweight. I can't lose weight. You know, I've tried to diet. I need to get my gastric bypass surgery or some other type of bariatric procedure covered. And this is going to be an enormous burden on our healthcare budget, but some would argue this is a good thing, because it will forestall many types of diseases associated with obesity. People who are overweight clearly are at higher risk for arthritis, they're at higher risk for stroke, heart attack, diabetes, and so on. And so it may be that this is going to usher in a new era in which millions of Americans will get corrective surgery and or pharmacological treatments when they're ready and appropriate. And right now, very few options in terms of safe and effective pharmacological treatments via drugs for obesity. But because it's a disease, so declared by the American Medical Association, they will be entitled to care. And this is a very, very interesting development. We're going to see what the ramifications are over time. Okay, did I call it or did I call it? This story is about prostate cancer, and I have long been a proponent of a more conservative approach to prostate cancer, because so many men undergo very aggressive treatments for prostate cancer. They have their prostate glands taken out at the earliest sign of prostate cancer. They get sometimes harmful radiation treatments. The treatment is very aggressive, and according to new studies, it may make very little difference. Now, this is, I'm going to add a caveat to this. There's, for some men, early detection and treatment of prostate cancer is very decisive and can increase their survival. But this is at the expense of a very large number of men who receive overly aggressive treatment, which causes them urinary problems, sexual problems, overall debilitation, and which ultimately doesn't affect their lifespan. And there's a big study out that confirms what I've been saying. This is based on studying 65 to 75-year-old men. And what they found is that there's a huge group of men out there who are probably treated unnecessarily, according to Dr. Julia Hayes, who led the new study at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, one of the world's finest cancer research institutes. So very interesting. I mean, here we're talking about cancer. Okay, you've got cancer. Don't just stand there. Do nothing. Well, not quite nothing. They examined the effects of three different strategies of treating prostate cancer. One was the full-bore treatment, you know, surgery or radiation treatment. The other was active surveillance, which is a very, very close following of the men, with a prostate-specific antigen PSA test every 3 months, as well as regular prostate biopsies, which are, you know, they're consequential. I mean, you know, stick a needle in there, and, you know, usually they're safe, but there can be problems. And then also digital rectal exam. So they're very closely followed. Then they looked at watchful waiting, which is a less intensive follow-up, with PSA tests only every 6 months and a bone scan every 5 years. So you would say, well, that's kind of complacent. You know, you got to watch these men more carefully, because they had initially a finding of prostate cancer on biopsy, but it was a low-grade prostate cancer that maybe wasn't going to affect them. So what they found was that the men's risk of ultimately dying from prostate cancer itself was lower for those getting active surveillance. Okay, it was 5%. But here's the scary part. It was 9% among the men who went straight to treatment. It was actually higher among the men who got treated. They were more likely to die of prostate cancer than the men who got active surveillance. So the big take home was that men in all three scenarios had a very similar risk of dying. They were all, in all three groups, they had a life expectancy between 81 and 82 years in any case. So it appears that observation can help men live a similar length of life, prevent death from prostate cancer, and avoid the harms associated with early treatment, according to some of the top prostate cancer researchers. And also the researchers comment that the model findings could also apply to men in their late 50s and early 60s. The vast majority of the data suggests that observation is superior to earlier intervention with surgery or radiation, that it's even superior to active surveillance. It allows people to live longer, live better, and less expensively. And oh, by the way, when you add a proper diet, when you add nutritional supplements like pomegranate and green tea and extra vitamin D and fish oil, and the whole panoply of nutrients that we use for prostate cancer prevention, lycopene and anti-inflammatory products, this offers better prospects for disease-free survival and quality of life than going immediately towards invasive surgery or radiation.